Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I want to welcome you this evening to our Independent Policy Forum. As most of you know, or many of you know, we hold these events every month or two here at our conference center in Oakland. The Independent Policy Forum is a series of lectures, debates, and seminars on major social and economic issues, and tonight is certainly no exception. The title for tonight's program is The Voluntary City, Restoring Urban Life in Crisis Times. And we're featuring a book that we are proud to publish called The Voluntary City, which I hope everyone will get a copy. We're particularly delighted to have one of the editors and two of the authors speaking. We also have a third author in the audience here, Spencer McCallum. We're very delighted that he's joined us as well. For those of you who are new to the Independent Institute, hopefully you got a registration packet which explains our program and includes information about upcoming events as well as many of our publications and media programs. Our website is independent.org, and you'll find thousands of studies and articles on many different issues there. You're also welcome to subscribe to our weekly email newsletter, which is called The Lighthouse, which you can do at the on the homepage right at the top. Lighthouse is edited by my colleague Carl Close, who's standing in the back. And I also hope that you might consider subscribing to our quarterly journal, which is called The Independent Review. It's edited by Robert Higgs, and I think you'll find that the writing and content is quite sparkly and of interest to anyone interested in public policy. Across the U.S. and in California and the Bay Area in particular, most cities and states are in financial crisis. Of course, that doesn't include the federal government. One thing I also might mention before I continue is one other note in your packet is there is a copy of a program for tonight's event, and you'll see at the bottom on the first page that lists the program, you'll find information about our upcoming event, which will feature Richard Epstein from the University of Chicago Law School and the economist and historian Jeffrey Rogers Hummel from San Jose State. And the topic is called The Promised Land of the Free. It's based around a new book that Richard has done from the University of Chicago Press called Skepticism and Freedom. As I was saying, that around the U.S., many government units are in financial crisis. It's not just a question of the economy, it's not a question of the war, it's a question of many other things. In California, of course, with the repeal of the state car tax increase, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a, quote, public safety crisis, emergency, to address the fiscal crisis facing cities. But the question, at least one of the questions to ask, is what is the optimal mode for providing city services? Must cities be centers for crime, for homelessness, for traffic gridlock, for pollution, for unemployment, and many other social ills? Should urban reformers rely upon a political process that seems to pit special interests above community needs? Clearly, governments in most cities dominate a great deal of the decision-making that goes on in cities. One of the questions that we have is what is the outcome of that, and how does it affect the kind of problems that exist and the possibility of coming to grips with real solutions? This evening, our speakers will provide a rich history and dynamism of what might be private, market, and community approaches to providing superior social services, urban infrastructure, and community governance. Our first speaker is Peter Gordon, who is professor of economics and former dean of the School of Policy, Planning, and Development at the University of Southern California. He received his PhD in regional science from the University of Pennsylvania. He has served as director of research at the Planning Institute. He's been a fellow at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. He's been a research scholar at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. He's also been a visiting lecturer at UCLA's School of Architecture and Urban Planning. He's a co-editor of The Voluntary City. I'm very pleased to introduce Professor Peter Gordon.
Thank you. There is a handout here
for those that haven't got it. And this was going to be the overheads, but we have this instead of the overheads. And I have my pointer, and so we can do it like this, or you can look at this thing if you like. Okay. There are, first of all, some themes that are dominant in the book that my colleagues will probably elaborate. The school that I'm in at USC is called the School of Policy Planning and Development. And the mantra of the school and our reason for being is that we put together what's going on in the public and the private and the voluntary sectors, three sectors. And one premise of this book is that there are really two sectors. There is the voluntary sector and there is the coercive sector. That we have really two impulses. We are self-regarding and other-regarding. We are not, as economic analysis would suggest, self-regarding only. We are a complicated blend of self-regarding and other-regarding. And that it is useful to look at the institutions that people create to channel both of those impulses. So it is well known that markets channel our self-regarding impulses into some pretty good things. And one theme that comes out here is that people have also developed institutions that channel our other-regarding impulses. And maybe that's been overlooked. And so we're highlighting all kinds of arrangements. Before there was a welfare state, there were safety nets. Before there were cities, there were rules of property. Before there was municipal zoning, there were rules of property. Before there was public schools, there was education. Before there was government or modern government, there was infrastructure and so forth. And the episodes that are discussed in the book, which some of my colleagues contributed to, document how and why that really happened. And that often happened spontaneously, people taking spontaneous action. And some of you may have read recently, I think one of our colleagues was lamenting the fact that when he's on an airplane and he talks to co-passengers and he reveals that he's an economist, and then people immediately ask about the stock market, of which he knows nothing. So he decided that rather than admitting or confessing that he's an economist, he's going to from now on say he's someone that studies spontaneous orders. And that's really what it's all about here. So we are examining a bunch of institutions that come to us bottom-up, and we compare these to the traditional impulse to look at top-down institutions only or mainly. Now, that dovetails into the discussion that we hear so much about what the hell is civil society. And we're told, and I heard this appellation only recently, that the second Wilson administration, the one in power, the first one was interested in exporting democracy, and the second one is interested in exporting civil society. And you're supposed to laugh because I'm referring to the Bush administration, but I have to be clear about this stuff. Anyway, what do we before we export it, what do we mean by civil society? And I've listed six things in your handout that I think work for me, and this is point number two if you want to go there. Certainly, one element of phenomena that occur when people are left to their own devices with a minimum of top-down rules is specialization and trade, which contributes to economic growth, and that's the one that Adam Smith and so many others wrote so much about.
but there are other aspects. People fashion practical institutions, auspiciously the common law. They form all kinds of communities. They form voluntary charitable mutual aid associations and safety nets. They supply what some of us in the book call market-challenging goods. And in the book, we take issue with the idea of market failure, and the mantra being the mantra in neoclassical economics that the model fails in certain episodes, and therefore there is market failure, and therefore the public sector has to do something. Well, the analysis in the book says no. These are more likely to be market challenging episodes. And it is surprising what it is that people do, left to their own, that resolves those episodes. And then, of course, they create social capital. So of those six dimensions of civil society, the first one is well attended to. The other five are less well attended to. And there is a book that I recently read that I quite enjoyed, which is the Brink Lindsey book, and something about the dead hand, or some of you may have read it. And he talks about the 20th century fling in the world with socialism in Europe and progressivism in the U.S. As if that fling is over. And of course, that fling is not yet over. In the early 21st century in America, we have some very pricey compassionate conservatism. And if you look at the proposals, for example, I mean, the reforms of Social Security, and I think all of us agree that Social Security can stand some reforming, are really paternalistic for savings plans. And it's an open question to how much of a reform they are. And some of the authors will talk about some of the episodes here, but the episodes highlighted in the book have to do with the private provision of police services, the private provision of zoning, the private provision of highways, infrastructure, and so on and so forth. And one theme that comes out is that we may have gone full circle. We may have gone through an episode where some spontaneous orders were in fact crowded out by the expanding welfare state, but which are now coming back onto their own in spite of the welfare state. And one of the most important mechanisms that's going on here is people voting with their feet. And people voting with their feet is a phenomenon, is a dynamic phenomenon, which, you know, we've known about since the exit voice loyalty discussion. But in a more prosperous society, there is ever more likelihood of more people voting with their feet. And it's interesting to look at those dynamics and to look at the kind of responsiveness there is on the supply side when people take those actions. There is considerable discussion in the book of what people did spontaneously to alleviate various market failures. And our colleague Alex Tabarrok calls that refutation by existence, meaning that there are textbook writers who worry about public goods and cite the lighthouse and as an example of market failure. And you guys have quite a bit to say about the lighthouse. In fact, it is all over the place, right? And those are people, I think, starting from Paul Samuelson on down, who may never have left their office and never realized that there was considerable experience of lighthouses being supplied on a contractual basis. And likewise, there's the birds and the bees, or the beekeepers and the apple orchard and all that, where people that our colleague Alex called economists, who he called theoretical empirics, meaning they get their data from the theory and then move forward. But the writers in this book, including some of our colleagues here, get their data not from the theory, but they get their data from the data, and they in fact go in quite different directions. There is some discussion in the book of what people do or what people are able to do when they are living in a regime of flexible institutions which are able to accommodate an open-ended future. And they do a lot of good things, and again, this goes back historically, and some of it is re-emerging today. And that's perhaps interesting because there's this new word running around, this new term, and it's called sustainability. And there's all kinds of money, if you're interested, available from various institutions and government agencies if you're going to say something intelligent about sustainability. Well, that really is the premise, that a closed-end future is a good thing, that it's plausible and useful. And almost all of the episodes depicted in the book suggest that a closed-end future is not the way to go, and good for us that there wasn't such a concept, or that there wasn't the rage for sustainability 50 or 100 years ago. Where would we be? In terms of the built environment, which many of us are interested in, there is some discussion of the demand for the rules of property. And the demand for the rules of property is quite clear. Americans, not just Americans, but many others, own a portfolio of assets, which is a little bit odd if you look at it from a textbook point of view. It's remarkably undiversified. And people like to plump most of their assets in their residence and in their home. And if people are going to own such a risky and undiversified portfolio of assets, then they have a demand for rules of property that are going to make that a less risky proposition. And one way they manifest that demand is that they want zoning and such things. Well, not only did covenants and land use and land rules predate zoning, but they're coming back into their own. And many of you know that since the 1970s, there's been an exponential growth in community associations, which have a lot to do with replacing conventional rules of property. In fact, if we disregard international immigration for a second, I think within the U.S. there are three migrations that are going on which are noteworthy. People are moving from the Frost Belt to the Sun Belt. And many of us smug Californians look at the newspaper and the news every day, and we see the weather storms that are happening in the Northeast and the Midwest and so on and so forth, and we smile, and the Pilgrims made a mistake and landed the wrong coast back in 1620, and that random event is slowly being corrected over the last several hundred years, and that's one of the migrations, the Frost Belt to Sun Belt migration. The other migration that's auspicious is the migration from conventional traditional city centers to the suburbs and into smaller communities, and the third is into private communities. And we're told that right now about 20 million housing units, or 50 million Americans, are in private communities. And of course, many of us make all three moves simultaneously, right? We move to the Sun Belt, into an edge city and into a private community. People voting with their feet in large numbers and often choosing this aspect of privatization are really upending much of the discussion of regional governance and all such things, which some of the elites talk about, but which most Americans are not interested in. There is a debate, an interesting debate going on right now, some of it in these pages, some of it beyond these pages, whether or not private communities and small local cities are complements or substitutes. The agreement is that they both come about because people want to protect the public good, which is the neighborhood quality, which has significant repercussions for their own wealth, and people will do things to make that happen. And to what extent are the two moves complementary, and to what extent are they substitutes? And of course, those are interesting areas of research. Nevertheless, people voting with their feet are choosing rules of property that are much more endogenous than the top-down models would suggest. When we look at the world this way, then we see that there is significant mitigation of some of the market failure concerns that have been so robust in the textbooks for so many years. Fred Foldvary will talk in a few minutes, and I think Fred is the inventor of the term territorial goods, is that correct? Okay. So Fred has helped us out by pointing out that most public goods have a spatial ambit, and because they have a spatial ambit, their benefits are capitalized in the value of land, and because their benefits are capitalized in the value of land, they're transactable. And because they are transactable, things work out, and they are not necessarily a textbook example of market failure. Many of you have experience with commercial malls and industrial parks and trailer parks and all those things. And you know that entrepreneurs and developers make it their business to internalize the externalities, to arrange the uses, and to arrange the rents such that a proper and certainly non-chaotic arrangement of uses occurs. I teach in a real estate development program at USC, and a lot of developers of commercial malls come in and explain to us why it is that they want to give a good deal to the Nordstrom coming in because it maximizes the value of all of the other parcels that they're lending out. So none of that is surprising, and of course leave it to entrepreneurs to discover the solutions before economists ever do. What are some other issues or questions that are presented by this discussion? First of all, some discussion in these chapters suggests that we're now looking at a dynamic market for constitutional rules. That is, that developers of private communities, trailer parks, industrial parks, shopping malls, and so on and so forth, are in the business, especially on the residential side, in presenting, coining, authoring rules of property which have to pass a market test. Very little is known about what kind of opportunities are available for both municipalities and developers, given that rules are now having to face this market test. Another part of the discussion has to do with, well, if you've done any development in your life, you know that there is quite an approvals process that you have to go through, especially in places like California. And we're now told that there is more value added in getting through the approvals than actually putting something on the land and improving the land. And you laugh, but I'm afraid it's true. And what that really means is that there is a transaction taking place. You get the approval if you kick in certain goodies that the zoning board and these other boards like. And one of the authors in the book, Robert Nelson, suggests that the transaction be made explicit, and that it becomes explicit if, in fact, it is a neighborhood association dealing with applicants rather than the neighbors, the applicant, and the zoning board, which is a three-party episode with two parties doing the negotiating, the third being left out and digging their heels, and we call that NIMBY. There is an interesting proposal by Robert Nelson in the book about privatizing older and inner city neighborhoods and suggesting how that might be done, how state law has to be changed, but suggesting very strongly that not much of conventional policy has worked in favor of revitalizing inner city neighborhoods, and perhaps if the denizens of inner cities had some ownership rights of the public spaces and facilities in their neighborhood, that things would get better quickly. There is an interesting suggestion, and Spencer is here with us, and Spencer talks about, well, it talks about the hotel, right? And other such examples. And Spencer, and he can speak for himself if he likes, says that these episodes that we're talking about are the way station because they still involve politics, and that an all transactions model is the way to go, or is the way we will go, we expect to go, we think we'll go, anyway. And he has quite a lot to say about the hotel as an all contractual arrangement, which seems to work out pretty well. Anyway, where's all this going? There are all kinds of suggestions in these chapters, so my colleagues will elaborate on these. It is unclear the extent to which reform mayors and other leaders will take these up, especially in times of some of the crises that David Thoreau alluded to. The rules of property and land use planning come from many sources, including what some of the authors call entrepreneurial planning. And are we finally going to say that planning need not be an exclusively top-down activity, but it can be a bottom-up activity too? As I may have said in the beginning, this gets us back to a discussion of civil society, which now makes it into the newspapers even. And if we're going to export it, then perhaps we should better understand it. I finally want to call your attention, and it's not in the book, and where are we about this? In the Freeman or something like that, lifesharers.com. Okay. And lifesharers.com is, if we had another chapter in here, I think, or in volume two. As you know, people die all the time because there are no organs for them. And there is rationing by waiting and dying. At the same time, there are laws at the federal and state level that say you cannot transact, buy, and sell organs. And that's the reality, right? People are dying, and there's the law. And what is so interesting about lifesharers.com is that spontaneously and on his own, this man, I don't even know his name, created a website that you can all go to where you can sign up to donate your organs should the circumstances arise. And the point of doing so is that you are enrolled in a network whereby network members have first dibs on your organs, and if you need them, you have first dibs and other members' organs. And the network is growing, it's on the web, and all that, and it will save lives in spite of the law. And it is spontaneous, and it is created quite inauspiciously by one individual at a time. And, of course, the question raised by some of these discussions is how many other episodes like that are there going to be in the service of our welfare and our benefit? Thank you, Peter.